We have two cases today, but before we begin, I'd like to welcome Senior Judge Ryan back to the bench. As you may know, our fifth judge has not been confirmed by the Senate, and Judge Ryan has graciously agreed to help us out with two cases today and another case, the Horn case, in March. So we're delighted to have her back. We appreciate her service, and we'll proceed. Okay. Commander Riches, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
And Lieutenant Royal, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Commander John Riches, and I represent the appellant, Lance Corporal Christopher Nelson. I respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. At issue in this case is whether, under the totality of the circumstances, Lance Corporal Nelson voluntarily provided his telephone passcode to law enforcement. The court below found that he did. That decision was an error for two separate reasons. First, the court applied the incorrect standard of review. It applied a clearly erroneous standard to the legal question as to whether Lance Corporal Nelson's statement was knowing and intelligent. Second, the statement was not voluntary because, first, it was only made under threat and then presentation of a search authorization, and second, it was only made after Lance Corporal Nelson believed he had, quote, no choice but to make the statement.
So on your first point, we pierce the CCA decision and look at what the MJ did, the military judge did, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So is your argument really less focused on what the CCA got wrong as compared to your argument is what we should do correct in terms of the application of the standard?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I think it's appropriate to raise the standard of review issue, of course, because it seemed like it was sort of a central component of the CCA's decision. The CCA characterized this question of knowing involuntary waiver as a, quote, close call. And additionally, I think it's important because, of course, the burden is on the government to prove knowing intelligent waiver. And based on the CCA's decision, it almost appeared to invert that burden and require appellant to come forward with affirmative argument evidence that the waiver was not knowing and intelligent.
Now, in terms of your second point, I want to make sure I better understand the foundations and the boundaries of your argument. So I'd like to pose to you a hypothetical. Let's say everything is the same, except for appellant did not utter the words, I guess I don't have a chance. Let's say instead he's presented with a search authorization by the investigator, and he kind of slumps in his chair and immediately puts in the passcode. How, if at all, would that alter the substance of your legal argument here?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, it would alter the question of voluntariness in toto, because, of course, when we're examining voluntariness, we have to ask whether it was coerced. And we know from this Court's jurisprudence, from McLean and White, we know from the United States Supreme Court in Bumper, that the threat or presentation of a search authorization is itself inherently coercive. And we also know from this Court's decision in Bubonics, and I direct the Court to footnote 2 in Bubonics, this Court applies the same analysis when it's determining voluntariness of consent in the Fourth Amendment context as it is when it's determining voluntariness of a statement in the Fifth Amendment context. So I think because of that line of cases, the threat of the search authorization alone is enough for this to be an involuntary statement.
Now, there had been essentially, you used the word threat. Let's just say that the day before, there had been the assertion by the investigator that he intended to get a search authorization. Appellant continued to say, no, I'm not going to enter the passcode. So would it be a logical extension from your argument that at any point, in any case, if law enforcement presents an accused with a search authorization, that by its very nature, that would overbear the will of the accused?
I'm not sure we need to go that far. I think Bumper mostly stands for that proposition, where you had law enforcement agents show up at an older woman's home. They presented search authorization, and the United States Supreme Court declared that that alone was inherently coercive. But I'm not sure we need to go that far in this case because of the way the record is established. As the court is aware, there was two separate interrogations. And during the first interrogation, the law enforcement interrogator asked for consent to search five times. Can I search your phone? No. Can I search your phone? No. It was only after the law enforcement agent, at that point, threatened to obtain the command authorization for search and seizure, that appellant said, well, I guess at that point I'd have no choice. What's interesting about that is the very next day, during the second interrogation, when appellant was actually provided with the CAS, he said the very same thing. Well, I guess I don't have a choice. And I think under those facts, Your Honor, where there's five refusals, the bumper line of cases, and then where there's these statements when the CAS is interjected that I don't have a choice, I think that points to very strong, conclusive evidence that it was involuntary.
Counsel, just a little foray and a slightly different question. Was there any question that this was appellant's phone?
Your Honor, no. There's nothing in the record to indicate that.
Okay. And second question, was there any problem with the search authorization? Was it defective in any way?
No, Your Honor, not to our knowledge.
So talking about a Fourth Amendment, looking at this from a Fourth Amendment point of view, agree or disagree, you go to someone's door and you knock on the door and say, may I come and search your house? And their option is to say no, right? Or you can say, but I have a search authorization. And then they can say, well, you still can't come in, right? And you can break down the door, right, to effectuate the search authorization, which is, from a policy perspective, more preferable.
Well, absolutely. What's different, though, Your Honor, about the Fourth Amendment context is, of course, law enforcement is going to get in that situation. They're going to break down the door no matter what. And in that case, the declarant would have an interest that his or her property not be destroyed. In this case, in the Fifth Amendment context, it's not certain, and certainly on this record, it's not certain that law enforcement is going to get in to the phone, and the declarant doesn't have the same interest. I don't want my door broke down, as they do here when they're giving up a phone passcode, because it's not like they'll smash the phone or something like that.
Do we know that the techniques that the investigators use to break into phones are not destructive? I mean, I was under the impression that those often can render the phone unusable going forward.
On this record, it is unclear. I would say it's just slightly different from the breaking the window or the door circumstance.
I'm curious about, you've repeatedly used the word threat. He threatened him with the search authorization. I don't really understand the context of the word threat as the way you're using it. What is the threat here?
Well, maybe I should be clearer, too, about the two separate interrogations. So during the first interrogation, when the interrogator asked for consent to search, appellant said no twice. After the second time, he said, well, at that point I'm going to go and get a search authorization from your commanding officer. That, in my view, was a threat.
It sounds like a statement of fact that was true. I mean, it sounds like he was informing him of what was going to be the consequences of his actions. He wasn't saying, if you don't do this, I'm going to hit you. That's a threat. I mean, but did he not have every legal right to get a search authorization?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But, of course, it's the context in which he was making the statement. When he was asking for the phone, and when he ultimately knew that he was going to require the phone's passcode. And I think under those circumstances, if he's holding out the search authorization to compel the entry of the passcode, that creates an inherently coercive situation.
But, I mean, in the interrogation context, I believe that interrogators can flat out lie to people, right? They can pretend that they know things that they don't actually know. They can pretend that they have a search authorization that they don't actually have, right? I mean, those are all permitted interrogation techniques, aren't they?
Those are absolutely, Your Honor, those are permitted interrogation techniques. But
why, when they actually have a search authorization, is it an impermissible technique to ask him about something that is like, I mean, we can disagree, and I do disagree that there's anything incriminating whatsoever about someone having a passcode to their own phone, right? I mean, that doesn't seem particularly incriminating to me, right? If there's a question about whose phone it was, yes. But if there's no question, I still don't understand why that would be incriminating, right? But why is it trickery or unfair to say I have a search authorization, right? So you can open the phone, or I can use a search authorization and I'll open the phone.
To your first point, Your Honor, is entry of a telephone passcode itself incriminating? This court in Wallace did address that issue and determined that entry of a telephone passcode into a smartphone is, in fact, the type of incriminating information that's protected under the Fifth Amendment. To Your Honor's question, the reason is because the court, of course, has to examine whether under the totality of the circumstances this was inherently coercive and whether the appellant voluntarily and knowingly and intelligently waived his rights. And under those facts, based on the Bumper, McLean, and White line of cases, the presentation of the search authorization is inherently coercive, and we know it wasn't knowing and intelligent because the appellant said so in no uncertain terms.
Counsel, on this last point that, about whether it's incriminating, could you address what the government says in the first footnote of their brief? They say that even if this court were to conclude that the statement wasn't voluntary, we would still need to remand in order for the lower court to determine whether it was testimonial and incriminating. Do you agree with that?
I don't, Your Honor. I don't think a remand would be necessary in this case for a few reasons. It's obviously a fully developed record, so this question as to whether providing your telephone code is testimonial, we believe that's been resolved by the United States Supreme Court. That was the Hubbell decision, 530 U.S. 27. In there, the court laid out the scenario where somebody were to provide the combination to their safe versus providing the key to your safe. And, of course, the court said if you provide the combination, that's testimonial. It's our view that providing a smartphone passcode is analogous to providing the combination to a safe. The 11th Circuit, Your Honor, squarely addressed the testimonial question. In re grand jury subpoena deuces tictum. That's 670 F3rd 1335. There they said that a defendant producing data that's protected by a phone triggers Fifth Amendment protection because it would be testimonial. And then, of course, this court, Your Honor, in Mitchell squarely addressed the question as to whether or not providing your smartphone passcode is incriminating. And there the court said that it does qualify as incriminating information that's protected in the Fifth Amendment sense. That's at 76 MJ 418.
Counsel, you refer to the fact that we have to look at the issue of voluntariness contextually. What is this court to make of the determination below that the statement in regard to, well, I guess I don't have a choice, that the invocation of his right to withhold his passcode would not benefit him? What should we do with that interpretation of the statement by appellant?
That providing the code or that withholding it would not benefit him, Your Honor?
Yes, and that's the reason why he put in the passcode. It was not a situation where his will was overborne. Instead, he made an informed, perhaps not correct, but informed decision, this is better for me if I enter the passcode.
I understand. I think what that demonstrates, though, Your Honor, this particularly his statements, I guess I will if I don't have a choice, I will if I don't have a choice, it wasn't knowing and intelligent at that point. Because every time the government introduced this idea of attempting to search his phone or review the contents of his phone, the reaction from Lance Corporal Nelson was exactly the same. I guess I don't have a choice. And so when the government, and maybe it was, I mean, at the time he signed the rights waiver, he certainly agreed to talk to law enforcement, although the rights waiver only involved allegations of drug use and nothing else. But once you interjected this issue of the search authorization, at that point it changed. And at that point it wasn't knowing and intelligent because it was very clear that Lance Corporal Nelson didn't want to provide the passcode so that a search would inevitably occur.
Counsel, on that point, on the rights advisement, he was told that he had the right to remain silent and that anything he used is said to be used against him. And he essentially, and assuming that giving the passcode, as you said, is an incriminating statement, he's now saying, well, I thought that I had to make a statement and I didn't have a right to remain silent. How do you square that with his saying that he understood his right to remain silent?
Well, I think this is a little bit like Wallace, Your Honor. So in that case, you had a 26-year-old appellant. He was an E6, by the way. And in this case, appellant is an E3, and he's 25 years old. And the appellant there originally consented to a search of his computer. And then he wanted to withdraw that consent. And what this court held is it wasn't reasonable for a 26-year-old E6 to know, he wouldn't have the knowledge that he was able to withdraw the consent he had previously provided. I think that's a very similar circumstance here. Once you had the circumstance where the CAS was introduced, it was not clear appellant knew what the effect of that was. He didn't know whether or not that meant the government can automatically search his phone or not. So at that point, providing the passcode became something that wasn't, his waiver was not knowing intelligence, under the burden of proof that the government bears, Your Honor.
What if they'd given another rights advisory? What if they'd said, well, now we have a search authorization. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you. Will you give us the passcode?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that certainly would have helped on the question of both voluntariness and knowing an intelligent waiver at that point. And additionally, if the rights advisement had included any other allegations, again, the rights advisement here pertained only to drug use, to which appellant admitted during the course of the interrogation. It did not pertain to any other criminal misconduct.
There's no evidence that the government knew of any other misconduct at that point before they searched the phone.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So they can't warn about something they have no idea about.
It's unclear from the record after the first interrogation if they had derived any additional information, but it's unclear in the record, Your Honor. Turning very briefly to the question of inevitable discovery. So the government asserts, and again, it's important to point out that the government bears the burden by preponderance of the evidence to prove that inevitable discovery actually applies. The government asserts that the defense laboratory has the capability of unlocking phone passcodes. What they don't show at all is that they have the capability of unlocking this phone. And in fact, the government's sole witness, when pressed on this point, when asked, do you know whether the lab would be able to successfully unlock the phone? The witness testified, I did not. No, sir. And that's at Joint Appendix 66 to 67. Admittedly, that witness's testimony is all over the place, but taken as a total, it certainly does not satisfy the government's burden to prove inevitable discovery. Your Honor, I see my time is up, if there's any additional questions.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Roy.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Ryan, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Blake Royal, and along with Mr. Brian Keller, we represent the United States. This court should affirm for two reasons. First, appellant voluntarily provided his passcode. There was no Fifth Amendment violation. And second, even assuming a violation, the United States would have inevitably discovered the passcode. Suppression is not warranted.
In regard to your second point, how on this record could this court find inevitable discovery?
Yes, Your Honor. Given that this court reviews motions to suppress in the light most favorable to the government, if you take the testimony of the agent, where we have a specific finding of fact that he was credible, in the footnote, military judge points out that the agent, the reason he makes the finding of fact that the appellant declared, I guess I don't have a choice, as opposed to what he testified at the 39A, was because the agent was more credible. We had a credible witness who is talking about, and if appellant is selectively citing questions from his cross-examination, but on redirect and questioning from the military judge, the agent was specific that in the last 2 or 3 years, that he had sent 4 or 5 phones to the lab, And of those four or five, only one had not been opened, and it was a more advanced, a much newer phone. It was an iPhone 8 versus an iPhone 6S. He specifically said that of the two iPhone 6Ss, the two other iPhone 6Ss that the agent had sent to the lab, they'd both been opened in a matter of days.
But I think the characterization of Pound's counsel is correct in terms of saying that the investigator was all over the lot in terms of articulating the standards, saying at one point did you know whether or not DSFL would be able to successfully unlock that phone? The investigator replied, I did not know, sir, it's a case-by-case basis. And then you had the trial counsel saying that he, referring to the investigator, at least made it appear to think that that was a possibility that it would eventually lead to unlocking the phone. Based on that record, how do we find inevitable discovery?
Again, Your Honor, in the responses to the questions by the military judge and the redirect from trial counsel, eventually we get to a clear experience. You're right, Your Honor. The agent was a little all over the place, especially during cross-examination. However, we eventually get from him, and I think that response to the, did you know at the time that you'd be able to open the phone, he says no. But between the interaction on May 1st with Lance Corporal Nelson, and by the time he's testifying at 39A, he's had more experience. He's sent two iPhone 6Ss to the lab, and they've been unlocked. I think because of the standard of review we have for the motion to suppress at this level, that the agent's testimony, although at times confusing, the totality of his testimony, we have those clear, succinct facts. He sent four or five phones. Only one of those phones has not been opened, and that phone was more advanced than the one appellant had. And of the two phones appellant that were the same make and model of the appellant's phone, both of those phones were opened. I think that's sufficient to meet preponderance of the evidence, given that we review the evidence in the light most favorable to the government. Moving to voluntariness.
Counsel, before we move on, I have another question about inevitable discovery. Is there any limit to the type of Fifth Amendment violation it can cure? Are we suggesting that no matter how egregious, say the investigators went in, this is not this case, but say they went in and they beat him or they did other terrible things, they locked him in a room for 16 hours, would the government come in and say, well, we would have broken the phone anyway? Is there any limit? It seems very odd, the incentive structure of applying the inevitable discovery doctrine in this circumstance. It seems like it sets up very strange incentives. It seems like the government can do whatever they want to force an accused to give up their password, and then they can come back on the back end and say, yeah, but we would have broken it anyway. It just seems, certainly the Supreme Court has said inevitable doctrine applies to these circumstances, but is there any limit on this?
Your Honor, I think in circumstances where this court would need to send a prophylactic message to law enforcement, this behavior is unacceptable, that maybe a refusal to apply inevitable discovery would be appropriate. However, the interactions we have in this case don't trigger a need for this court to send a prophylactic message to law enforcement, hey, knock it off. This is unacceptable behavior. The interactions we have here were cordial, were brief, no coercive language or gestures were used. This is a circumstance in which it was a cordial, not a dangerous interaction with law enforcement, Your Honor.
Now, your appellant's counsel says that the presentation of the search authorization was a threat that it was inherently coercive. What is your response to that?
A threat is something that's impending. On May 1st, when he presents a search authorization, it is a fact. It's not a threat, I'm going to. It is. I have the authority to search this phone. The question then presented to the appellant is, are you going to unlock it or are we going to unlock it by brute force? This is not a consent case. The United States had authority to search the phone. We are not in the circumstance of, like, Bumper, where the sheriff lies to grandma about having authority to search the house. We had a search authorization that was lawful based on probable cause because the appellant had confessed to drug use. Had appellant acquiesced on April 30th, we may be in a different situation. We may be in a situation where the discussion of a search authorization was closer to Bumper or White. But because the appellant was able to assert his rights on May 30th during the discussion, well, I'll get a search authorization. Okay. At that point, I may not have a choice, but right now I'm going to assert my right. You cannot see my phone. We understand that one, it is not a threat. And if it were to qualify as a ploy to get access to the phone, it wasn't successful.
The appellant stated that he believed he had no choice but to answer his phone. Does the government have any duty to correct that incorrect statement?
An ambiguous statement like, no, Your Honor, an ambiguous statement like, I guess I don't have a choice, is exactly the type of declaration from a suspect that the Supreme Court was worried about in Tompkins citing Davis when they warned of a standard that would require law enforcement to be constantly guessing at the meaning of a defendant or a suspect under interrogation. When an ambiguous declaration, I guess I don't have a choice, which may mean that he doesn't clearly understand his rights. However, it also may mean, as the CCA found, that it no longer it's a fatalistic declaration. It no longer benefits me to assert this right. The Supreme Court in Bustamante was clear that knowledge of a right to refuse is but one factor. And this court in Mott found that what's required or expected of a suspect is that they understand the nature of the right and how it interacts or applies generally, but not in every instance or every type of question from law enforcement. To adopt the standard that appellant is asking for would create is one, not required, and would be unworkable. It would require a judge's understanding of the Fifth Amendment jurisprudence by every criminal suspect being questioned. And for that reason, the specific ambiguous statement, I guess I don't have a choice, is not fatal to voluntariness, given that all of the other factors weigh in favor of voluntariness. We have an appellant who was articulate, an interaction that was cordial, limited in time. We have an appellant who the previous day was able to assert his rights and refuse to answer questions. And I also think it's telling that appellant was a savvy actor. He was presented with evidence from a witness and text messages that he had exchanged with that witness discussing his drug use. He is able to determine in that instance, the government has strong proof that I've used drugs. And he concedes on that point. It no longer benefits me to obscure my drug use. So he concedes, he admits, yes, I've used drugs. But he is extremely limiting in that admission. He says, you know, he talks about two lines of cocaine. And then when asked about the phone, he is able to understand, I don't want them to see the additional evidence in this phone. You cannot search it. And it's not until he's presented with a search authorization, knowing that, hey, they're going to get this phone, it no longer benefits me to assert my right here.
Counsel, you cite a case from the Fourth Circuit, Olied?
Oliede, I believe, Your Honor.
Right. Is that case in line with other circuit court decisions on this same issue? where there's no question about who owns the phone. Like, that's not the issue. The question is simply whether the act of unlocking the phone presents a constitutional problem.
Your Honor, from my memory, I believe that a majority of the circuits, when there is no question about who owns the phone, do follow the Fourth Circuit jurisprudence. But I'm not sure if what the balance is exactly. There is a circuit split on when there is a question as to who owns the phone, but I believe the majority of the circuits, when the ownership of the phone is not in question, find as the Fourth Circuit did.
And that's whether there was or was not rights warnings, correct?
In Olguiere, there was not a rights warning. You're correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, related to that point, you heard counsel for the appellant address the first footnote of your brief, their position was that we would not need to remand if we found this was involuntary, that we could just decide the questions of whether it was testimonial and incriminating. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, remand is not necessary. This court could certainly make that determination. We would ask, however, if this court finds that the appellant's entering his passcode was not voluntary and that we would not have inevitably unlocked the phone, that if this court is going to make the determination on testimonial or incriminating, that at the very least give us an opportunity and the appellant an opportunity to brief those specific issues.
But why should we do that? The CCA addressed this issue. You didn't substantively raise it. You simply threw down a footnote. You're essentially saying, let's change the rules if it looks like I'm going to lose, aren't you?
Your Honor, we previously... Because if the interaction is voluntary, is the dispositive question, even if it's a testimonial or an incriminating act, the United States chose only to brief on that issue because we believe we win on that issue. And given the granted issue at this court, we again chose to only respond to the granted issue. It's the position of the United States that it is not an incriminating act.
It's the position of the United States what?
It is not incriminating to enter a passcode in a phone when presented with a search authorization. But we believe that it would benefit this court in your decision making if it were fully briefed by both appellant and appellee. Barring no other questions, the United States asks that this court affirm because the appellant voluntarily entered his passcode, and we would have inevitably unlocked the phone had he not.
Thank you. Commander Richards.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. On the question of inevitable discovery, not only was the witness that testified to inevitable discovery all over the map, as the Chief Judge observed, with respect to the ultimate question, do you think you'd be successful? I did not. No, sir. He was all over the map, even with respect to his knowledge of these phones. At Joint Appendix 66, he said he had experience with two phones of the same model as Lance Corporal Nelson's. At Joint Appendix 77, he said he did not have experience with similar type devices that were involved in this case. So on this record, that is not, the government has failed to meet its burden there. And, of course, they had an opportunity to develop the record on this question and did not below. The government's counsel indicated that these interactions, the interrogation, were brief and non-coercive. The first interrogation was 2 hours. During that time, the appellant was asked 5 separate times for consent. That is not sort of just a brief, only if you'd like to give me consent if you like. And then, of course, there was a new subsequent interrogation.
They asked him, and he said no, and so they did what law enforcement should do, right? They went and got a search authorization.
They did that, Your Honor, after having asked him an additional 4 times and after telling him that if he didn't give consent, then they would go and get a warrant, which, as we know from Bumper and White and McLean, is the sort of inherently coercive activity that this court should discuss.
So, counsel, question, and it's a similar question that I asked the government. Can you cite to any Federal Circuit Court of Appeals decision where a person was asked to unlock their phone, and there was no question that it was their phone, where they found that it was either involuntary or that it was incriminating?
Your Honor, Mitchell found this court in Mitchell.
I'm well familiar with Mitchell. I dissented. So I'm asking you a different question. We're now 3 years down the road, right, at least. And so I'm asking you a different question, which is, are you familiar, or can you cite to us, any Circuit Court of Appeals opinion where there's no question whose phone it was, where a circuit court either found that the mere question of will you unlock your phone was somehow made it involuntary, or that it was in fact incriminating?
The closest decision is the 11th Circuit case in re grand jury at 670 F 3rd 1335, where the court found that asking somebody to compel something that's password protected, data that's password protected, triggers Fifth Amendment protection because it's testimonial. On a final point, Your Honor, as to the ambiguity, this court has to ascertain whether the statement was voluntary, whether it was knowing, whether waiver was knowing and intelligent. I don't have a choice. Can't get more unambiguous than that. And I see my time is up if there's no additional questions.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks parties for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:45.